You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello and welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today on this, fourth week of Lent?
It's
all a blur. You know, my mind gets foggy because of the
intense... Because you haven't eaten in 4 weeks.
Yeah, it's the rigorous fasting, you know, and just because I'm so intensely holy, I lose track of time because I'm caught up in... the mystery of my own holiness. And so there it is. Whatever Wednesday of Lent it is,
that's right.
It's been 3 or 4 weeks from that. I'm looking forward to Laetare Sunday so that I can give my priests a hard time, which is, that's one of the,
unlike what you do all the rest of the year.
Well, normally, you know, I mean, I'm pretty good to my priests.
Yeah, I'm sure you are. By the way, I'm Rod Bennett, Mark's regular Wednesday afternoon co-host.
Sorry
and
about that.
And this is Mark Shea, and I'm not sure he even introduced himself. So anxious is he to talk to me.
Well, it's true. Yes, I'm Mark Shea, and you're listening to Connecting the Dots. And this is Wednesday, so you're listening to my my co-host, Mr. Rod Bennett. Swell guy, raconteur, all around knowledgeable about more arcana than you will ever know. And and he brought that arcana to bear today. I was so pleased. So my kids, my two oldest boys, were having this discussion on Facebook, as they are wont to do. This is the sort of thing that consumes their attention and mind. They started talking about what would happen if Dracula and the Hulk got in a fight and who would win. And what if, you know, would Dracula acquire Hulk powers from drinking the Hulk's blood? And
would the Hulk turn into a gigantic Hulk vampire, more powerful than Dracula?
Yes, more powerful than Dracula. These are the kinds of questions. You know, my question, of course, first is, given that bullets can't even penetrate the Hulk's skin.
Cannon shells can't penetrate the skin.
So I'm not really sure that a bite from a vampire is really something he needs to worry about. I think that Dracula would just kind of break his teeth.
Although, keep in mind, Dracula's powers are not of this world.
Well, that is an important
strange preternatural powers supplied to him to the Prince of Darkness. So who knows what's possible under those conditions.
It's true. These are things to think about, you know, as
they
make our way through life. And that's what my guys were talking about today, which, as I said, when I saw that conversation, I was like, I'm not sure if I should be proud or ashamed that they're having this conversation.
Well, I can vouch for this. I can vouch for the fact that your sons are quite capable of having a very deep and important conversation, too.
That's true.
Since I've done it with them a couple of times on memorable and enjoyable occasions.
Yes.
So, no, they're not. They don't spend all their time with their heads in such matters. But they're pretty deep kids. So you should be proud.
I am proud of my kids. Actually, they are great guys. And we have lots of interesting and hilarious conversations. We spent last Saturday night playing a fun game, which, if you're looking for a fun party game for really a group of any size, you can do it. You can even do it with just two people. There's the game where you write down, you come up with the name of some figure. It can be fictional or historical. Write it down, and then you tape it to the forehead of the person sitting next to you. And then they have to try to guess who they are.
How famous do they have to be? How famous is famous?
They don't have to be famous. And in fact, of course, the more obscure, the better if you're trying to win this game. So I turned out to be Thidwick the Big-Hearted Moose. This was the name given to me by my wife. And so it took me a while to figure that one out. But anyway, if you're looking for a fun game, it's really quite a fun game. And we had a hilarious time playing that game.
That sounds great.
So that was over at Luke's house. Luke is our oldest son. And then his brother is his next oldest brother is Matthew, known to one and all, including his wife, as Cow. There's a whole story
indeed,
to that.
Which indeed.
I will not go into here. But anyway.
Well, I think you were going to say that Rod stepped in and supplied the information that Marvel Comics has already addressed this issue.
Yes.
Whether what would happen in a clash between the Hulk and Dracula.
You know, and that's why I pay you the big bucks, Rod.
that's right.
It's because you know these things.
Marvel's been in business for 60 years now, or close on 60 years, if not actually 60, and putting out multiple books every month. So it's hard to think of a scenario that they haven't thought of already.
It's true. They even did a comic book, Life of John Paul II.
I remember when that came out. I wasn't Catholic, and but I still thought it was cool that that John Paul was a Marvel superhero.
Yeah, I thought that was really awesome. I don't know if they've done one about Francis or not. I can't remember if they did one about Benedict. John Paul's life is so epic. I mean, it really, you know, it would be hard to do, I think, a comic book version of Benedict XVI's life. Because it was mostly spent, you know, like in a library or an office.
Writing profound books.
And writing things, yeah. And writers, unless you're Ernest Hemingway, writers don't really live epic lives, you know.
I spent too much time indoors, behind the pushing a pen around.
Yep. Mark Twain, you know, he had some cool adventures and was a riverboat captain and fought in the Civil War. Well, kind of fought in the Civil War, sort of, for about a week. And, you know, and did interesting things and panned for gold and all that stuff. But most, I can attest, as a writer myself, writers do not live epic lives. If you tried to do a comic book version of the life of J.R.R. Tolkien or C.S. Lewis, I mean, you get some cinematic moments in the trenches in World War One.
Right. But sometimes you have to be inventive. Right. I happen to have a good friend by the name of Micah Harris, who had a graphic novel published by a pretty prestigious graphic novel outfit called Heaven's War, where the Inklings, meaning C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, Charles Williams, and their cronies, literary cronies, go up against the arch Satanist himself, Aleister Crowley. So it's great. It's really, really well done. And Micah knows a lot, although not Catholic. Micah knows a lot about the Anglo-Catholic and Catholic theology, and he did a great job. So you can make a superhero type story out of. Actually, they don't have superpowers and fight the guy, but they use their wits. It's theological mystery that they solve. So
that's fun. I have to check that out.
Yeah. What's Heaven's War by Micah Harris.
Heaven's War by Micah Harris. Okay. Yeah, that's a fun idea. Yeah, I think
so you can do comic books about those guys, but not very factual comic books.
Right. There's a terrific fun writer named Tim Powers who writes these just bizarre kind of supernatural thrillers. And he will always incorporate into them real historical characters. And the constraint that he operates under is that everything that his characters, the historical characters in the novel do, has to have actually been something that they really did. But then he'll take, you know, minor incidents in their life and then construe all kinds of horrendous and terrifying significance into, you know, this minor thing that once happened, you know. So he wrote a book called Declare in which Kim Philby, the British spy, winds up being part of this gigantic supernatural satanic conspiracy that involves the whole founding of the Soviet Union being done in order to placate gigantic demonic powers that require, oceans of blood in order to satisfy them. And it winds up having genies and Noah's Ark in it and all this stuff. But it's all set. It's like this Cold War story.
Right.
You know,
right.
Until all of a sudden, you know, what you thought was just this kind of ordinary spy story turns out to be this just amazing story
about cosmic,
this cosmic
powers and principalities.
Yeah, yeah. So he's lots of fun. Tim Powers is the guy. There's all, he wrote a book called The Anubis Gates. So this is a good example. The Anubis Gates winds up being this story about, you know, Egyptian magicians and all of this occult activity and all this kind of stuff. But in it, we meet Lord Byron. And it turns out that there's a story that Lord Byron tells in one of his letters where a friend, several friends in London reported that they saw him walking around London when he was in Greece. And there's no way that it could have been him. And so Powers pulls that. Yeah, so Powers pulls that into the story, and you know, we wind up with this Lord Byron doppelganger and all of this other stuff. We'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett talking about, well, we'll be talking about all kinds of interesting arcana right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello, and welcome back. Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and I will not be defeated by Ludwig von Beethoven. My voice shall be heard. There we go. And we are here today with Rod Bennett. We've been talking about all kinds of fun arcana already today.
In high spirits, as usual.
In high spirits. If you want to join the conversation, if you feel like being in high spirits with us, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. And
you did have something approaching a real subject on your mind, did you not?
Well, yes, but this stuff is always fun to talk about, too.
Yeah. Here I am trying to press your nose to the grindstone.
We spent the break talking about Christopher Lee. You know, one of the guests we've had on our show, John Farrell, I had him on my show a couple of weeks back. Interesting guy. He writes for Forbes, and he did a biography of Monsignor Georges Lemaître, a book called The Day Without Yesterday. Georges Lemaître was the guy who formulated the Big Bang Theory. Like me and you, he's a Tolkien geek. I actually did an interview with him once where we spent an hour kind of doing the autopsy on The Hobbit. And, lamenting how much Peter Jackson screwed up The Hobbit. But he had the chance a couple of years ago to do an interview with Christopher Lee. And are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah. Oh, okay. That's cool. Okay. I'm just enthralled, spellbound by your story. Do continue.
Okay, so if you go online, actually, you could probably just Google John Farrell and Christopher Lee, and you could probably find somewhere his account of his visit with Christopher Lee. So he and Lee were I don't know if you call them friends, but certainly acquaintances. John's just a super interesting guy. And he's kind of got his finger in all of these, especially in the interface between faith and science. He's very interested in that. A deathless foe of intelligent design theory, because he's a Thomist, among other things. Anyway, just a really interesting guy. But you made me think of that when you started talking about Christopher Lee.
Which the audience didn't get to hear, but that's okay. We no need to go back over all of it. I will say it's very interesting, and it's something our listeners might want to know, that Christopher Lee apparently is somebody who apparently got much more serious about his Anglican Christian faith as time went on, and apparently died a pretty serious Anglo-Catholic Christian. And a lot of it was under the influence of his friend Peter Cushing, who had died some years earlier. They're one of the great movie teamings, you know. Cushing usually played the good guy to Chris Lee's villain. Mm-hmm. But by most accounts, Peter Cushing is a pretty saintly character, and people always speak very, very highly of his Christian faith, which he was a pretty shining light for in the film industry. So it's a story that I would like to know more about, but... a lot of it's kept quiet.
Though a lot of people don't know. I mean, he was in fact so holy that he was actually able to come back from the dead just to be in Rogue One.
He made an appearance. You know, that's funny. It's funny you should mention that. We have a historical marker not far from here that recounts the fact that Bishop Francis Asbury, one of the first two Methodist bishops personally consecrated by John Wesley himself. There's a story behind all of that, but that's for another day. They both were sent to America to be bishops for the Americans who, after the Revolution, didn't have the King of England as the head of their church anymore, so they needed bishops. But Bishop Asbury came to East Tennessee in the early 19th century, into the neighborhood of where I was born. So there's a historical marker that recognizes it. But the historical marker says Bishop Asbury came to a certain farm here and held his revival meetings, and he preached here in 1818. And I thought, my goodness, that does deserve a historical marker, because I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Bishop Asbury died in 1816. So if he came here and preached, then that is worth commemorating 2 years after his death. I probably should contact the State Historical Society about this, but I doubt they'd make up a whole new marker, even if I told them.
Well, still, that's pretty cool. I wanted to just mention something here. That irks me, and I thought it was it's important.
Under your skin.
It's under my skin. So here's the deal. You know, we're living in a time where the pro-life movement, the Christian, the Catholic Witness, is facing a lot of challenges. And it's the last thing I think that the pro-life movement needs to do is invest itself in having fights, especially the Catholic pro-life movement does not need to be investing itself in having fights with the Catholic Church on its own teaching. So there's one of the things that comes up constantly, and the biggest backers of it are self-described pro-life conservative Catholic Christians, is the death penalty. The church has taught and has been teaching since Evangelium Vitae in 1995, I think, was when Evangelium Vitae came out. Essentially what the church did was it said, look, yes, The death penalty is not intrinsically immoral, like, for example, abortion is. Something that's intrinsically immoral is something that can never be justified under any circumstances whatsoever. It's always wrong, period. So you can never take innocent human life, period. But what the church has taught down through the ages is there are times when the state can inflict the death penalty. What happened in 1995 was that the church said, although the state can inflict the death penalty, unless you absolutely have to do it, then there's no good reason to do it. So don't do it. And so the church basically said to first world countries, look, you've got ways of keeping killers from harming people. So use those ways and don't kill them.
I think it might be worth pointing out, if we've got any listeners who might be on the fence on this, as I was myself for a long time, that the whole thing, the whole discussion needs to happen under the umbrella of the church's entire mind on the subject of a just war or just uses of violence.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of harm is done in the world and in our country by even Catholics and other Christians who think that once a war is declared, things that used to be evil are not evil anymore.
Right.
In other words, once the gavel comes down on a war declaration, shooting a man, you know, in the back or cutting his throat or whatever, these other things that used to be, blowing large numbers of them up in a military base or whatever, deliberately planting bombs, blowing up bridges with people on them, things of this type, all of this that used to be ghastly horror, once the declaration of war happens, there's an indulgence granted. The nature of the thing has changed, and this awful stuff can now be done not
with
only
the blessing of the church,
but cheerfully.
Right. Oh, and we're up against the break.
The idea is that there's some sort of temporary indulgence has been gained because of the fact that we're in a war.
Rod, we're up against the break, but we'll be back after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark. Oh, I thought I heard the music play. Okay. Well, then never mind.
A couple more minutes.
My mistake.
Well, I'll continue my rant for another minute or two then.
Okay, go ahead.
No. The truth of the matter is the church always teaches the same thing about this kind about violence, period. The only time when it's justified is in self-defense.
Right.
Okay. We haven't miraculously turned something that used to be immoral into something that's okay.
Right.
We just simply continue our teaching that in order to save your life or somebody else's life, violence might be acceptable under certain conditions.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, a great deal of ambiguity is contained in this idea of what constitutes self-defense. In other words, a war declared for the purpose of defending Belgium, for example, might be... You might define self-defense very loosely, as governments are inclined to do, because everybody likes to believe that what they're doing is to defend somebody or themselves.
Right.
Now I hear the music.
Now the music is playing. All right. And we will continue this discussion when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Rod Bennett, and we'll be back right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Hello, and welcome back to the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Mr. Rod Bennett. We were talking, and by the way, if you want to join the conversation, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. We're talking about a new book that is going to be coming out that is called By Man Shall His Blood Be Shed, A Catholic Defense of the Death Penalty, which I think is about the least
timely,
least necessary book that Catholics need right now. You know, ever since 1995, Evangelium Vitae basically said, unless you have to execute somebody, don't execute them. And so the whole emphasis of the church is on saving and redeeming human life, not destroying it.
Right. Just to take another second or two to finish the point from before the break, the church has no power to grant something that a murder should be licit. What the church says is that in self-defense, you might use violence to protect yourself or somebody else who's being threatened. This same idea rolls over into the church's teaching on the death penalty. The church basically says that a death penalty may be enacted for self-defense. In other words, it may be enacted in order to defend the existence of your society.
Right.
Now, obviously, there's a lot of wiggle room in there, and that's the reason why there's been different emphases about this through the history of the church. Right. But the whole thing has to be framed in these terms, that the church is not taking something that's evil and turning it into good by using a magic wand.
Yeah.
What the church is doing is saying that this thing can occasionally be done in self-defense, and we feel like that nowadays the idea that the death penalty is mainly for self-defense, it doesn't wash as well as it used to. In other words, there's all sorts of other things that can be done that make it pretty clear that it's hardly ever strictly necessary, and that the only time that it can be done is when it's strictly necessary.
Right. Yeah, and so the whole emphasis, what the church says to people who want to enact the death penalty is that it is not a question of asking the question, when do we get to kill people?
As if a war or an execution were a kind of a holiday from being a Christian.
Exactly right. And this, by the way, was one of the arguments that was constantly made over the last 10 years in defense of torture. The argument that was put forward, I heard this a million times from people who wanted to defend torture, was this. Well, we're at war. And in a war, you get to kill people.
That's right. The ordinary rules don't apply. When is a murder not a murder? When you're in a war.
That's right. And so you get to kill people in war, so why don't you get to torture them, which isn't even as bad as killing them? And what that entire argument is predicated on are the words get to, as though killing people is a treat.
Yeah, and that's our Savior is a kind of a nasty schoolmaster who doesn't give this holiday very often, so you need to enjoy it when it happens.
Right, and in the same way, why don't we get to torture people? Well, the answer of the church is you don't get to kill people. You don't get to torture them. The reason you kill people in war is because you have to. And if you don't have to and you kill them anyway, you are what is known as a war criminal.
That's right.
So if you take somebody prisoner and then shoot them in the back of the head, that was not self-defense. That was murder.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why we Nazis were punished, including with the death penalty after the war, was because that was murder. Well, if you have someone as prisoner for the same reason, that means you don't get to torture them. Why? Because they're prisoners. They are in your power, and the church doesn't even say, well, get as close as you can to torturing them without quite doing it. What the church says is treat them humanely. So the way you treated people humanely during World War II was, well, what? Three hots and a cot. You know, they were given square meals. They were treated like prisoners, and you didn't torture them.
So
now
there were
acts of torture.
The reason that Pope John Paul did not change the church's teaching, even though the church had been pretty free with winking at the death penalty through the years, is because the church had always taught that this was being done for self-defense.
Right.
But it was becoming more clear that that argument that all this is being done for self-defense had ceased to be believable under modern conditions.
Right, right. And it's, you know, the real reason it's being done is for vengeance. You know, and all you have to do is just, you know, go look at the photos, you know, of the people, you know, when somebody's executed, there's always a mob outside the prison, you know, waving frying pans and et cetera, et cetera. It's very clear what this is really about. And this is one of the weird things about the death penalty is we say that it's a deterrent. So how do we inflict the death penalty? Well, we go into a secret room where no one can see what's done. And then we take the one member of our community who has sworn a vow to do no harm, and we make that guy kill the prisoner. That's right. Crazy. And
now, admittedly, just as in wartime, what actually constitutes self-defense is a thorny matter. Mm-hmm. We're perfectly willing to concede that. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody who enters a war, so Adolf Hitler entered World War II, saying the German people needed to be defended from Jews and communists and not enough living room and all the rest of it.
Right.
So everybody's got an argument for why what they're doing is really a piece of self-defense. But the fact that it's difficult and the fact that everybody uses this justification doesn't mean it isn't true.
Right.
And the fact that it's difficult to put your exact finger on the moment when self-defense is valid doesn't mean that the whole thing's not based on the idea of self-defense. It is.
Right.
So same is true with the death penalty, which is why I don't have patience with somebody who says free and liberal use of the death penalty, no matter what the sainted John Paul had to say about it. That I don't have any patience with.
Right.
I am willing to hear, you know, how many executions and under what circumstances are necessary. I can listen to a certain amount of that.
Right. Well,
because
the
church's message, John Paul's message, was always it ought to be greatly reduced, and I don't see how it's justified very often anymore.
Which was his entire point. What John Paul and Benedict and Francis have all called for is for the abolition of the death penalty. And what they've said is basically the reasons for it are so tenuous that, you know, this is a situation where you just abolish it. It's not necessary.
Right.
Francis actually called for the abolition of the death penalty again when he was here in the United States. And if we abolish the death penalty, guess what? We will be taken off a list that includes only, you know, the People's Republic of China, North Korea, and, you know, a dozen, you know, Islamic despotisms.
Right.
We're on a list with those countries and no other civilized nation in the world. And
which brings us around to the point of why everybody suddenly feels the need to bolster support for the conservative Christians feel the need to bolster support for the death penalty at this particular moment in time.
What's
driving this itch to say, by golly, this would be a good time to rush to the defense of the death penalty?
Well, I think there are a number of factors that part of it is simply traditionalism. It's, well, this is what the church used to teach, and therefore we need to ignore Evangelium Vitae and every bishop in the world, plus three popes, on this issue. But there are other factors that drive it as well. The United States currently is at this moment. And a lot of people are not aware of this, but the United States is now the largest prison state on the face of the earth. we have a larger prison population than communist China.
Right. Than the communist Soviet China. Union did at the height of the gulags and all the rest of it.
We have a bigger prison population than Stalin's. Right. A hugely disproportionate preponderance of that prison population are people of color.
Yeah. Now, the defense that's always thrown out is, well, are you saying that these people were wrongly imprisoned, that they didn't do the thing that they were convicted of?
Well, they did the thing that they were convicted of, but a lot of the thing that they were convicted of was, you know, having a joint.
Well, that's the real answer is why. And yes, they did the thing they were convicted of. Why did they do it? What is it about our society that drives so many people into crime?
Well, and why do we have laws?
What is it about our particular culture that condemns a whole class of people to incarceration?
Well, and selects them for incarceration. Mm-hmm. That's part of the problem, you know. We'll get back to this when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Rod Bennett talking about the death penalty and the dumbness of defending it at this hour in history. And we'll be back right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett. We've been talking about what I regard as the absolute absurdity of conservative Catholics frittering away their time and energy defending
conservative, meaning theologically conservative.
Theologically conservative, right. Catholics. Well, and politically conservative, because they go together a lot of times, although not always.
I wish that were more true than it is.
I wish it were, you know, but, you know, I am as theologically, I'm as conservative as a Catholic as you'll find anywhere. But the idea that, you know, what's really a great use of our time and energy right now is to battle the church on the death penalty and fight with might and main to keep the United States on a list with North Korea, the People's Republic of China, Afghanistan, and Yemen.
It's a very valid and interesting question. Why right now? You know, it's like I used to ask people during the first Gulf War with the President Bush the first. Why, when Saddam was being driven out of Kuwait, did he launch his missiles not at the invading Western armies, but at Israel?
Yeah. Yeah.
A similar question here is, why, when abortion is what you're... I mean, this is all being said in the context of the pro-life movement. Why is it that when abortion is the main thing you're concerned about, do we start pulling out other aspects of a certain package that you think it's connected to? Why do we start defending waterboarding and the death penalty and creepy stuff like that at a time when...
We say our focus is on ending abortion.
Yeah. Why would that happen? Why would that? It's like the missiles being fired at Israel. Why did that happen? Now, of course, the reason Saddam fired the missiles at Israel was because the whole purpose of his invasion of Kuwait was to try to create a pan-Arab uprising. Mm-hmm. And the easiest way to get yourself crowned the new sultan of all the Arabs is to start attacking Israel.
Right.
I think it may be a similar thing here. In other words, why do these people feel the need to attack these non-direct targets in the pro-life movement? that really have nothing to do with it. I think they're saying they've got a deeper logic in mind. They're saying that all these things are part of a package, and if you let the other things slip, I mean, because after all, there's very little practically we can do about legal abortion with the Supreme Court being what it is.
Right, right.
So they say, well, let's start defending the whole conservative package, whatever conservative means there.
Well, this book is a theological argument. So it's what it's doing is it's attempting to show the argument of Evangelium Vitae, which is now preserved in the Catechism and in the, you know, the instruction of, well, every bishop on planet Earth, plus the popes since John Paul II, they're united on this. Don't inflict the death penalty unless you absolutely have to, which means effectively abolish the death penalty. And this is a book that's attempting to defeat that teaching of the church. And the argument that's put forward is, well, it's just a prudential judgment, and therefore you can ignore it. Well, I would find that argument better if I had the slightest confidence that the people arguing for the death penalty had any prudence. There is no prudence to this that I can see. What there is the abolition of the death penalty and the church's hostility to the death penalty are, I think, at the end of the day, regarded as creeping modernism.
Right.
Somehow
that's what I was getting at. There's a whole package.
Right.
In other words, abortion is just a symptom.
Right.
In other words, there's this whole package we have to stand up against.
Right.
And it includes being a wuss about torture and all this other red-blooded stuff that we associate with law and order right. and conservative values.
Over-strictness about just war theory. You could just, it could be kind of just, and that's good enough.
Right.
If it's
right,
not right. entirely just, oh, well, we're that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I
mentioned during the break that there seems to be a kind of a reverse seamless garment at work.
Exactly.
It's like,
right.
Anti-abortion. Don't you understand? Anti-abortion is part of a bigger package.
Right.
And it includes all this other stuff, too. And if you
right.
start getting waffly and soft on this other stuff, pretty soon you might turn pro-choice.
Yeah.
The idea is you're giving aid and comfort to the enemy. You even have to defend totally indefensible political characters who claim to be conservative just because they're more conservative, perhaps, than their predecessor.
Right.
Sort of.
Yeah.
And so you wink at all of their errors. You have to get behind the deeply flawed character because anything else gives aid and comfort to the enemy. So there's a package deal here. We're defending abortion by defending a lot of other square-jawed, all-American stuff, too. And you got to get behind it all because it's all a seamless garment. See what I'm
there's
driving at?
Oh, yeah. There's an analogy. I was thinking about this today. Carbon monoxide poisoning works this way. Your red blood cells have a certain affinity for O2, for oxygen. So they go to the lungs, they pick up oxygen, then they go out to your cells, they drop off the oxygen, and they pick up a carbon dioxide molecule, and they take that back, and they let it go into your lungs, and you breathe it out. And the thing is that your body, although it's, fearfully and wonderfully made, as soon as your cells go outside the parameters for which they're designed to do the thing that they do, they're dumb. And one of the things about your red blood cells is your red blood cells can't really tell the difference between a carbon monoxide molecule and a carbon dioxide molecule.
Ah, okay.
And hemoglobin has 200 times the affinity for carbon monoxide that it does for carbon dioxide. So once your red blood cells latch onto what looks just like a carbon dioxide molecule to them, that's it. They never let go. And so if you inhale too much carbon monoxide, you die because your red blood cells can no longer carry the gases that they were supposed to be carrying, because they can't tell the difference. And I think a lot of times what's going on is you have a lot of Catholics who can't tell the difference between a legitimate development of doctrine and something that looks to them like modernism.
Well, probably a great many of us don't know from development of doctrine. Most of us have probably never heard the term.
Right,
so
right.
There is that.
Well, and so the problem is, and this in part goes back, frankly, it goes back to the priest scandal. When the magisterium is regarded as untrustworthy by the flock, they don't stop trusting a magisterium. They just go find another one.
Right, right, right.
And what they've looked for in a magisterium has been talk radio and the Republican Party platform.
I have been pushing for that people should learn the difference between a conservative mood, you know, just a desire to favor old-fashioned, stodgy things.
Right.
And some actual conservative principle. The people like I always liked in conservatism were people that were liberal in the sense of liberality, broad-minded, not willing to shut down on an idea until they were forced to, willing to, exercise and entertain all sorts of new concepts, you know, but for whom conservatism was more than just a stodgy mood. But
right.
A lot of people, they don't understand the principles involved, whether it's theological or political, don't mm-hmm. know much history or theology. And as mm-hmm. a result, they judge things by taste. They judge things by flavor, whether it has the right smell or not, you know.
Right. This and, seems like
so there's a conservative, there's a traditional sort of feeling, and they associate all sorts of nasty things with conservative or traditional that really have mm-hmm. no principle behind them at all. They're just, the thing they have in common is people used to say this stuff years ago, back before everything went to hell in the bucket.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that that's a lot of what drives it, is, you know, this, I don't know, this death penalty thing, you know, I don't remember that from when I was a kid. We used to have a good red-blooded, you know, hanging, and what's wrong with that?
I once knew a very sweet old lady who came back into the church, I'm pleased to say, under my influence. But she was an old lady from New Orleans, and one day she surprised me by telling me that she thought that a lot of the country's problems had started when the schools were integrated.
Yeah.
Because after all, think about it. You know, the schools were integrated in the mid-60s, and everything's gone to hell in a bucket since then.
It must be that. Yeah, exactly. You know, this is why we have a magisterium, and this is why it's so important to stick with the magisterium and listen to it and not fight against it.
And look for self-appointed alternatives.
I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, Rod Bennett. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. Our producer was Danny Head. I'm your host, Mark Shea. I will be back tomorrow with Deacon Stephen Gridonis talking about life at the movies. Have a good evening. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.